Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is novelist Alexei Zentner. Zentner is an assistant professor of English and creative writing at Binghamton University. He is the author of two highly acclaimed novels. His first, called Touch, was published in a dozen countries and shortlisted for several awards. His current novel, The Lobster Kings, published by W.W. Norton last month, has been named one of the must-read books of summer by the New York Post and Boston Magazine. Zentner's fiction has appeared or is forthcoming in magazines and journals, including The Atlantic Monthly and The Southern Review. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, The Lobster Kings is set in a fictional place called Loosewood Island, and it's supposed to be somewhere between Maine and Canada, but to me it seems like this mythological place. How much time did you put into the setting?
What happened is that we went for vacation down in Maine years ago. I mean, my kids were really young at the time, and we went camping, which somehow seemed like a brilliant idea with, I think, a 2.5 and 4.5-year-old. And I really just fell in love with the landscape down there. There's something incredibly appealing about how rugged the terrain is, sort of these cliffs just meeting the ocean. And I wanted to set it on an island because I was interested in this idea of sort of what it means to have a community that is buffeted against change. And so I wanted to sort of write about a place that was in some ways timeless, but also really struggling with what it means to have change come to a place like that.
Yeah.
So I spent a fair amount of time down there, took several trips for research, you know, which was actually a pretty easy sell. I suppose if I ever, you know, write a novel set in sort of an urban decay area, I'll have more trouble selling my family on that. But, you know, when the research trip is, hey, let's go down east, that's a pretty easy sell for the family.
Yeah. Well, it certainly works. It almost feels like the setting's one of the characters in the book. So this is an epic story of a family who's lived on this island for 300 years, the ancestors. Talk to us a little bit about the Brumfitt.
Right. So Brumfitt was the first of the King's family to live on Loosewood Island. And he came nearly 300 years ago, and he was a lobster fisherman and a fisherman, but he was also a painter. And he, in the book, plays this sort of role of, you know, not just the family history, but he's a well-known painter, sort of like Winslow Homer meets Andrew Wyeth.
Uh-huh.
And he's sort of one of the first great American painters. And so you get tourists coming to the island to actually sort of trace the footsteps of Brumfitt and paint some of the same landscapes. And he's this incredibly sort of mythic figure because it's not just his role as a painter and the family's namesake, but in some ways it's sort of what he's passed down to the family. One of the family legends is that once he'd been on the island for about 8 years, he realized he was lonely. And the sea, as a gift, gave him his wife.
I love that image.
Thanks.
It was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. And so what happens is that his wife, you know, comes to him from the sea. And there's a question of whether or not she's a Selkie, which is this sort of myth of a seal that sheds its coat and comes to shore, or whether she was from one of the native tribes in the area, or where she comes from. But the family myth, at least, is that as she is sort of washed ashore, she brings a dowry. And the dowry that she brings to the family is that for each and every generation, they get the blessing of the sea. But, you know, the problem for the King's family, there's a price to pay. There's, with every blessing, there's a catch. And, you know, the curse for this family is the loss of every firstborn son.
Yeah. I love that you put painting into it. It did invoke Winslow Homer. And you use the paintings to write the history in many ways. Did you do a lot of research in order to put that into the book in that way?
Well, so let me address the question of research first, because it sounds like I'm being a little flip when I answer this question, but I try to do as little research as I can get away with.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is that for me, and every writer, of course, is different, but at least for me, if I do too much research, I end up writing a book report. I feel like, you know, if you put all this work into the research, then I sort of feel like I have to put it all on the page. And so my goal is to do just enough that what I have on the page feels real, and not so much that what I have feels forced. But I did a fair amount of research on lobster fishing and the area. I had several large maps that I used for reference to make sure that even though my island is imagined, that where I had it located was sort of geographically correct for these other towns. And I did a fair amount of research about sort of, again, fishing. But even some of the questions, one of the things for Brumfitt, the painter, that I had to think about was, well, where would he get materials? And I realized, you know, that you know, canvas, we think of an artist's canvas, is essentially sailcloth. So for him, that was where he got a lot of the material. So I did definitely do research. But for me, at least, the worry is that if I do too much, I become pedantic.
And less of a novelist.
Absolutely.
And you don't pass on the imagination that people need to even see the images that you're writing. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
No. So the narrator of this, and I loved her. I love having a heroine. Is the great 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 granddaughter Cordelia Kings? Yeah. Tell us about her. Where did she come from?
So Cordelia is, I mean, she is feisty. You know, she is very invested in sort of maintaining the family tradition and protecting the island. But to do this, to protect the family tradition and protect the island, she has to do the most untraditional thing she can, which is to step into a role that's been traditionally reserved for men. And she's somebody who says, I don't care how it's been. This is the way it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, a lot of this comes from, I'm a feminist. I've got two daughters. And I want to raise these kind of girls. I want girls who grow up to be these kind of women. And so I was interested in that question of what does it mean to be this kind of a daughter, to be this kind of a woman, and how do you sort of grow a daughter like that? And so a lot of the book is really about the relationship between her father, Woody, and Cordelia. And so it was important to me to have Cordelia be somebody who was strong and who was also human and flawed. I mean, I think she's a really vibrant narrator, and she's not perfect, and she's sort of as lonely and hopeful and as able to be hurt as any other person.
Yeah, it's a very interesting character. I'm very happy to see her develop as I was reading the book. And I love that her competence spoke for who she was instead of her making these big statements. You know, often people overwrite feminist women.
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. I mean, I think, in some ways she's very much your own creation, and yet she's also modeled on all the strong women I've had in my life.
I was going to ask you about that. So that is where she came from, a compilation of people you've known.
Very much. It's funny because I one of the things that drives me nuts as a teacher when I teach writing is when somebody says, oh, a woman wouldn't do this. And my response is always, well, maybe you haven't met the right women. and your conception of women might not do that, but a woman would. Women and men come in so many different varieties. There's no singular flavor.
Did you think they question you because you're a man writing a female character?
I do.
That's an odd statement.
It is an odd statement. And what's interesting is I've been getting that question a lot, sort of, why did you choose to write in the voice of a woman? And the really honest and short answer is, why not? I mean, it never even occurred to me to question it until the book came out and people started asking me about it. And I think that stems, again, from this idea of a woman's voice. And I guess I believe there isn't a woman's voice in the same way there isn't, sort of a male voice. There's just sort of singular men and women. Nobody can write the female voice in the same way that nobody can write the male voice. Yeah, you can only write these individual characters. And
So you're creating voices in many ways. I thought she was very real.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you about that because so few male novelists want to use women as their protagonists.
Well, I think,
that's the other side of it.
The default voice for a fiction writer doesn't have to be your own. I mean, it shouldn't be. I mean, part of being a fiction writer is being able to step outside of yourself. But I think, look, if we're being honest, there's been a real, and it's a problematic tradition of privileging sort of that male narrator, that male voice, that if you write about a woman, often the book is described as quiet or domestic or whatever.
And even if you're chick-lit.
Or chick-lit. And if you are a woman writer and you're writing about women, it gets marginalized. Whereas if you're a male writer and you're writing about women, I'm thinking of particularly Jonathan Franzen with his most recent book, Freedom, which is really just a domestic novel, somehow it becomes elevated. Mm-hmm. And I guess for me, when I think about what I want to do, I think what most writers are trying to do is to write, sort of the great American novel, whatever that is. I don't know what that even means. But I guess, the question is, why can't my version of that have a woman's voice?
Yeah, and well, it should, because women are underrepresented, and I think even if you as a male writing it elevates it, that's fine for this moment.
Yeah, and I didn't want to write a woman. I wanted to write Cordelia, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. I can do.
I want to talk about the fact that this book is loosely based on King Lear, mm-hmm. at least it is, as far as I have read. I didn't really notice that much of that in there. There isn't the insane madness and death. But to tell us about that evolution, did you really base it on that? Or?
Well, I've been calling it sort of a riff on King Lear, mm-hmm. Which I think is maybe a better way of putting it. Because, there are books and movies that have been retellings of King Lear. I mean, Jane Smiley's A Thousand Acres is a pretty you know, faithful retelling of King Lear.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's a beautiful book, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something that was my own. And, you know, one of the things I say often is that I believe that all literature is in conversation with all the literature that came before it. And I didn't want to just sort of echo Shakespeare's words back. I wanted to sort of move the conversation forward.
Yeah.
And for me,
to make it more contemporary.
Absolutely. Well, and part of this, again, comes back to this question of sort of what it means for me to be a feminist and to have two daughters, is that I wasn't interested in the question of what it means to give up your kingdom. I was interested in what it means to be the one who inherits the kingdom, who has to step in that role. But I think there's, you know, as I started writing the novel, and I sort of realized what I was writing about, this question of sort of family history and, you know, what you inherit. And I'd already named the family the Kings, that very early sort of this motto of Lear became obvious to me. And some of that stems from, at least for me, when I was first falling in love with literature was when I was in university. And I happened to spend a semester in London. I took a Shakespeare class. And I had this professor who was just this mean guy. I remember liking him, but I've talked to some people recently who said, I guess he made a lot of people cry. But he had a big beard, and he smoked a pipe, and it was kind of like, you know, you could smell him coming before he got there with the pipe smoke. And when we were studying Lear, as we got to the end of the play, you know, he takes the role of Lear for himself, of course, because that's what you do when you're the professor. You get the good parts.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're at the very end where Lear comes out, and he's holding Cordelia in his arms and Cordelia's body. And I'm not spoiling anything for the Lobster Kings here because, again, it's a riff. It's not a retelling.
Yeah.
But in the classroom, I remember my professor, he's sort of cradling this imaginary body, and Lear says, essentially, you know, Cordelia, will I see you again? My professor says, and we have the text in front of us, so we know what he's going to say. He's going to say never, and he's going to say it five times. And he says, you know, never, never, and he, never, never, and that's the fourth time. And the fifth time, you can see he's struggling not to cry. It's all he can do not to cry as he whispers, never. And this play for him, this 400-year-old play, was so alive and so vibrant that it was all he could do not to cry. And here's the amazing thing. He was going blind, which if you've read Lear has all this resonance.
Yeah.
And he was so in love with Shakespeare that he committed to memorizing the complete works of Shakespeare so he'd have it at his grasp. And for me, at sort of this time when I'm 20 and I'm just falling in love with literature and I love Shakespeare and it's something that feels alive to me, to have that moment, sort of that incredible passion, was really something that obviously stuck with me.
Yeah.
It's probably actually the only thing I really remember about
so
college.
You've come full circle in doing the riff.
Yeah.
Now, your storytelling is steeped in this magical, what they used to call magical realism. Mm-hmm. But where did that come from? How did you fall in love with that? Because it's beautiful.
Thank you.
It's absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
The magic and the, you know, almost myth.
Thank you. I think a lot of people still call it magical realism or fabulism. I'm kind of picky about it. I actually call what I'm doing mythical realism, which I do because I feel like magical realism is so firmly rooted in sort of the cultures of Central and South America
and
Europe. And I've read, I love Marquez and I love those books, but I think if you take that and just sort of plonk it down here in North America, you end up with something that's kind of a palimpsest, where you're seeing sort of those cultures showing through. And I really want to write books that feel North American. So I wanted the myths that we're dealing with to be sort of our myths, which in a lot of ways have these broad strokes that apply throughout the country. But some of that comes from just, like, North America's really big. and it allows for a lot of space. I mean, it allows for a lot of ideas to take hold. But I think ultimately one of the reasons I write about these myths is because I'm interested in the question of wonder, and I believe that if you look, it's kind of everywhere.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Alexei Zentner. We're talking about his new book, The Lobster Kings. Talk to us a little bit more about this magical realism thing, because it seems to me that North America needs more of it, so I'm always happy to see it in your book. I also want to remind my listeners that you were born in Canada, and then you still have Canadian as well as American citizenship, so you're sort of immersed in both worlds.
Yeah, I was born and raised about an hour west of Toronto, and I lived there till I was, I think, 19. So I've lived almost exactly half my life in the U.S. now, and my parents were American, so I've always had dual citizenship. But because of that, I'm both at home and at sea in both countries, and so I think I look at things a little bit obliquely, and maybe some of that, what that means is that things that I think if you grow up in the U.S. or you grow up in Canada, you sort of take for granted as sort of part of the national mythology seem a little odd to me. I mean, you know, for the U.S., the great example is sort of the cowboy, how it's still something we mythologize and how, you know, it doesn't matter where you live or if you've never ridden a horse, you see that cowboy and there's that little sort of yearning to buy whatever that truck is. And I think that that's really something that we love. I mean, there's really something beautiful and contradictory about being alive today. And I think part of that comes from this idea that we know so much, and yet we also understand that there's more we don't understand.
Yeah.
I think most adults have these superstitions that we sort of half believe, you know, where we knock on wood or, you know, where we're a little bit nervous about the number 13.
Yeah.
And yet we also don't believe it at the same time.
Well, I think this is an age of anxiety, and people are trying to find truths and things that they can believe in or something that'll help them hold on in some ways.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think a lot of that comes from sort of how quickly things are moving. It was not that long ago, you know, where if you look at a map and there's a blank space and it said, there be dragons, we thought, there be dragons. you know, it was not that long ago that there were great swaths of this country that were essentially unmapped.
Yeah, yeah. And now the dragons are our nuclear power and things that we have created in some ways.
Well, there's so much anxiety, and I think that we are less safe or things are worse now than they used to be. But I think the level of information about the anxieties is so much higher that it's constantly there. And I think that most of us look for something to soothe that, something to believe in. And so I think for most of us, there's a sense of what else is there out there to look for.
Mm-hmm,
But I'm also, a lot of it for me stems from sort of family storytelling. I'm really interested in the way in which a story then becomes a myth and gets passed down from generation to generation, the ways in which our sort of family history can shape or fail to shape us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it definitely shapes Cordelia in this novel. It's fascinating history. You know, I grew up by the sea in Southern California, and the way you write about the sea is so beautiful and so real. You must be attracted to the sea. Tell me how you feel about the sea as somebody from two different countries.
Yeah. Well, part of it for me is my grandparents lived in Florida when I was young, so I'd go fairly regularly to visit. But I love the water. There's something really stunning about the ocean. And I recently kind of said this to somebody, and I thought, oh, I like that. What I said was that it doesn't matter how much you love the ocean, it doesn't love you back. And it's this incredibly powerful thing. Like, one of the first things I taught my kids when I took them to the beach the first time is to never, ever turn your back on the ocean.
Oh,
uh-huh. And you see that. Every time I go to the beach, I see somebody who you look at them and you think, they're not really familiar with waves, and they're standing there, and they've got their back turned, and sooner or later, they get knocked down and tumbled around.
Yeah, yeah. You have to have a respect for it, yeah.
Yeah.
And I actually think it is my friend. That's probably a mistake, but I lived through it and, you know, lived in it as a child and had my knocks.
Yeah. Well, I think it's funny. A friend of mine, actually, who's another writer at Binghamton, you know, she grew up in Hawaii and spends all her tons of time there, and had a pretty good scare last year, you know, with the ocean. You think you know what's happening, and, you know, it's big and it's powerful, and there's this sort of incredible draw.
And, you know, that's one of the really beautiful things about your book, too, because there are still myths about the sea that we don't know. You know, part of me still believes in mermaids. I mean, frankly, we don't know exactly what's way down below in that dark, deep water. You know, we haven't been able to explore
it. It's the last great undiscovered place on Earth.
Yeah, I mean, there's... And you sort of evoke that in this book with the myth stories.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating.
Well, there's always been sort of this primal human draw to the ocean because it's both a place that can sustain us and that can allow us to travel. You know, I mean, you know, again, if we sort of think of the course of human history, it was not that long ago that we were afraid you would sail off the edge of the earth.
Yeah. I'm afraid some people still believe that.
But I think there's something really interesting for if you're living in a fishing village or living in a fishing town, it's the ocean is this place where it sustains you. It provides your life for you. And it also takes it away. I mean, it's incredibly dangerous. Mm. If you work on the ocean, you are taking a job where your life is in danger at every moment.
Yeah, exactly. And you portray that in the book. Now, the contemporary twist in this book is the drug trade that starts coming into this little innocent little island. Talk to us about that. I mean, you put that in because it's a contemporary...
It's also a personal interest. I mean, I've sort of family history, not not my own, but sort of extended family history with drug and drug trafficking. But it's also these small towns on the coast are getting, they're just getting destroyed. You know, now the book, The Lobster Kings, is set in about 2005, and so mostly talking about meth. But the current problem is heroin up and down sort of New England. It's just rotting these villages and towns from the inside out. And it's such an insidious problem, partially because of the money that can come with it. Mm-hmm. But I think meth is actually a really attractive drug for blue-collar communities, for communities that do physical labor, because at least at first, it gives the illusion that you can work harder, which means more money, which means things can go easier. And it's really sort of this corrupt rot that attacks. And often, of course, it's a corrupt rot that is brought in, you know, originally by somebody who's already on the inside. But I think it's a really, interesting question, because we're this weird time in our country where as we're starting to legalize some drugs, some other ones are getting out of control.
Yeah, it's interesting that that's happening all at the same time.
Yeah,
I was thinking legalizing drugs would maybe stop some of it.
Well, the problem is that I think when you talk about some of the, sort of the harder drugs, that the things that come with it can be so insidious that I don't know that there is an answer of any kind.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the book tells us as well.
Yeah,
yeah. I like the way you portrayed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed very realistic.
Thank you.
You know, some people put drugs in and it just destroys everything.
Yeah.
This seems more realistic. It's just in increments if you don't do something about it.
Right.
Which is what Cordelia and her friends decide to do. Very interesting. Now, both of your novels have gotten generally good reviews, especially Touch. We know about the history of that now. How do you deal with bad reviews? Do you learn something from them, or do you just dismiss?
It depends. You know, think about, I'd like to believe that I could be that author who I don't read my reviews. But I was actually talking with another author about this today, and I think that probably everybody who says that is lying. Particularly now with the internet, it's so easy to find them.
Yeah, and friends are sending them to you.
Yeah, it really depends. I mean, I don't, you know, I think that as a reader, people use Goodreads and the Amazon reviews, and those are fine. But as a writer, I try to stay away from them because I think those can be difficult. You know, the joke is sort of that you can get 999 great reviews, but it's the one bad one that sort of stays with you. In terms of learning from them, it really depends. I had because The Lobster Kings has only been out, I think maybe 3 weeks now in the U.S. They're just, you know, haven't had a ton of reviews yet or feedback, but it came out a little earlier in Canada, and I had this terrific review in the Toronto Star, which I loved because it was a great review. I mean, it was a rave review, but I loved it because it was really smart, and it told me some things about the book that I hadn't realized about some of the ways in which the book is talking about globalization and some of these other questions. And so the same can be true when you get a negative review that's smart. You can take stuff from that. But sometimes, you know, some negative reviews are not. If you get a negative review that is not a smart negative review, I think kind of all you can say is, oh, well, they didn't get it. Not the reader for that book.
Yeah, and Goodreads is especially insidious because it's not really professional reviewers.
Yeah.
It's people handing out opinions.
Now, that being said, I think what's interesting is that, you know, when my first book, Touch, came out, people who loved it loved it. And people who didn't love it, I'm kind of like, eh. When The Lobster Kings, it seems to be people who love it love the book. I mean, I've got some incredibly positive reviews. And people who don't like it hate it.
Really?
Which is actually really exciting because I think to write a book that gets that kind of strong reaction probably tells me that I'm doing something right. I'd rather have somebody, if somebody's not going to like the book, I'd rather have them be angry about the book than sort of just say, eh.
Yeah, and dismiss it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I want to ask you this as a writer, too. When you're writing a novel like this, and it's a complicated, pretty dense novel, did you get immersed in the characters so much that it's hard to leave them even when you're with your family or going out for a walk or visiting friends? Are you in there with those characters all the time you're writing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm fortunate that my daughters are now 10 and 12, so they're old enough now that there are times when I can just say, you know, I'm writing, I'm writing, I'm writing, I'm writing, and I have to say it about 6 times, and then they walk out of the room. And so I can get some of that space. But there are other times, too, where I'm with them and thinking about something, and I'm just completely distracted. My wife's learned that when she comes home, you know, she yells out hello when she walks in the door, and as she's coming up the stairs and as she's walking to my office, sort of calls my name several times to make sure that she doesn't scare the heck out of me. But, yeah, novels are big. And this is, you know, I wanted to write sort of a kind of an epic novel, sort of, you know, with that sort of that Shakespearean vein of sort of a grand tragedy. Mm-hmm. And you really have to be immersed in it. And I find for novel writing that if I take time off, if I spend more than 4 or 5 days away from it, that it takes a while to get back into it.
But so you can let it go in some ways.
I can. I don't like it, though. I think that it's easier to sort of stay, just to keep moving. It's a little bit like a shark, you know. If you keep swimming, it works a little bit better.
So in the other vein, then, when you're done with it, is it hard to let it go?
Yes and no.
Since it's your baby in some ways?
Sometimes it's, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, if you're not a writer, you know, you just see the book on the bookshelf. And you don't realize sort of how long it takes. I mean, from the process of writing it and then selling it and then revising it and revising it and revising it. And by the time it comes out, I've seen it so many times that it becomes a thing that I did, not a thing that I'm doing. And so often, you know, as I'm being talking about the book, it becomes a thing that was a while ago for me. I mean, some of the questions about, you know, when you started writing it, well, for me, that was 5 or 6 years ago when I first started working on it.
Is that how long it took you?
Yeah, but I miss it. I mean, Cordelia is, I think she's an incredibly interesting, complex character, and it's hard to walk away from her and to walk away from Lucid Island.
Yeah. Well, what do you hope people will take from this? It obviously hasn't gotten its audience yet. It's still new.
Yeah.
Well, what are you hoping people will take from it?
Well, I actually think the first thing you need to remember as a writer is that reading is supposed to be fun. If people don't want to turn the page, nothing else matters.
Yeah.
I mean, if people don't want to keep reading, I don't think anything else matters. But I guess I don't sit down and think I want to send a message when I write a book. I really just want to tell a good story.
Mm.
But I think, if anything, I'm sort of writing about sort of the complexity of family dynamics. I mean, the theme that I keep coming back to is the way that our obligations and duty to our family sometimes comes in conflict with our own personal desires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got that from the book as well. We're almost out of time. What next for Alexei Zentner? Are you working on another book?
Yeah, I'm always working. I mean, the beautiful thing is that I'm at a point in my career now where it's a career, and so I'm always working on a new book. Just finishing up a story collection and working on a couple new novels, sort of starting to get those in the pipeline. But it's been, you know, I've been sort of working on those for a while. It's slow and steady.
Uh-huh. And you also teach. Is that like a side job to you? Or
no,
novels are the main thing?
I've got two full-time jobs. I'm a novelist and a teacher. I love teaching. I love being in the classroom. Binghamton University is a great place to teach. It's really smart students. And I love being in there talking with them about writing. And when I'm not doing that, the thing I do to get a job like that is to spend a lot of time alone in a room by myself working on the next story.
Yeah. Alexei, do you have contact information you can give people so they can get in touch with you?
Sure. The easiest way to find me is through my website, which is Alexei Zentner, AlexeiZentner.com. And email's there, or you can follow me on Twitter, which is probably something like at Alexei Zentner. I guess I should know what my Twitter handle is. But that's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me.
People will find you. Alexei Zentner, thank you so much for joining us. Again, his new book is called The Lobster Kings. Go out and get it. It's a great read. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.